When Daniel was chosen, along with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, to undergo training in the schools of the Babylonians for service in the court of Nebuchadnezzar, this period of training was to last for 3 years. This 3 years would also be running along with the years of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, because Daniel was taken captive about the time that Nebuchadnezzar was made king. In the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, which meant, of course, that it was within the 3 years of training that Daniel and his friends were to take, Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he was very troubled by this dream. It was not your garden variety type dream, and Nebuchadnezzar knew it. God had also imparted unto him a sense of the importance of this vision, so that he knew he had to know the meaning of this vision, that he could not take a chance on misreading it. So he called his wise men in and asked them to tell him the meaning of his dream. And they said, "Well, O king, tell us your dream and we will be glad to do that." But Nebuchadnezzar said, "No, the thing is gone from me. You tell me the dream and the meaning of it." Well, these men were very shrewd, and they were extremely good at taking whatever happened or whatever somebody dreamed and making up some yarn to give it meaning. And that's what they had been prepared to do with Nebuchadnezzar. That's what they consistently did. But this time, Nebuchadnezzar had called upon them to do a thing that was absolutely beyond their ability, and they knew it was beyond their ability. And they said, "Why, O king, what you've asked is an impossible thing. There's no way we can do that. What you have asked is something that belongs only to the gods. Only they can do this, and they don't live in flesh." The king said, "You're stalling for time, and you had prepared lying words for me. And if you don't tell me what this dream is and what it means, then you will be put to death." And the wise men knew they were in trouble. And the king gave the command that all of the wise men, the magi and so on, were to be slain throughout the kingdom. And as Arioch, the guard, the captain of the king's guard, went out to execute this commandment, Daniel observed all of the urgency and all of the activity, and he asked Arioch about it, and Arioch told him what had happened. So Daniel tried to obtain time so that he could give the interpretation to the king, and he secured an appointment to go in unto the king. And Daniel told his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego about the matter and asked them to pray to God, and he would pray to God. And in the night, God gave Daniel the same dream that he had given unto Nebuchadnezzar. And he also gave Daniel the interpretation of that dream as well. So when Daniel came in before Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had given Daniel the name Belteshazzar. So he asked him, "Belteshazzar, is it true that you can interpret the meaning of dreams and tell me what my dream means?" And Daniel said, "O king, you have asked your wise men to do a thing that no man has the power to do. But I do serve a God who can tell the meaning of dreams, and my God has given me your dream and the meaning of it." Now, can you imagine Nebuchadnezzar sitting there on that throne looking at this man, and Nebuchadnezzar knows that he has not told a soul what that dream was. Certainly not what it means, because he himself does not know what it means. And he's going to be able to tell with the first words that come from Daniel's lips whether Daniel is telling the truth or not. And if Daniel is telling the truth, then it is true God is the only one who could have revealed this to Daniel. So Daniel started out and he said, "The God of heaven has told you, he has revealed unto you what's going to come to pass in the latter days. God has given you, O Nebuchadnezzar, a history lesson. And he has told you what's going to happen in the days that are going to come in ages in the future. What you dreamed of, O king, was a great image. And the head of this image was made of gold. The chest and the shoulders of this image were made of silver. The abdomen and the upper thighs were made of bronze. And the legs were made of iron, and the feet of iron and clay mixed. And as you observed, O king, there was a stone that was cut out of a mountain without hands. And this stone came and flew down and struck this great image in the feet. And when it struck it in the feet, the whole image just crumbled and fell to the ground. And the wind came and blew all of the pieces of the image away as if they were nothing but chaff and dust. Now, O king, this is what your dream means. You are the head of gold. Here you rule this vast empire, and you are a glorious and incomparable king. After you, there will be another empire to arise. And after that, yet a third. And then there shall be a fourth empire that shall arise. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people. But it shall break in pieces and consume all these other kingdoms. Now, O king, as you saw that the legs were of iron, and the feet and the toes were of iron mixed with brittle clay, so the power of this fourth empire, though great, would be brittle. Now then, Daniel did not go beyond that. He did not know to call that the Roman Empire because God did not tell him that. But what Daniel was telling Nebuchadnezzar was that you're a great king, all right, and you have a great kingdom. But your kingdom is not forever. It will be followed by other empires that will rule the world. But in the days of the fourth empire after yours, God will set up His own empire, His own kingdom. And unlike the kingdoms of men, it shall never pass away. It can never be destroyed. But it will outlast and overcome all of the kingdoms of men. Now then, later on, I'm going to tell you a little bit more about Daniel and his work with Nebuchadnezzar. But now, let's go back and notice the history of this thing. Now, Daniel and his friends went on with their training after that. But because of the Spirit of God that was in Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar greatly honored Daniel and his three friends and gave them preference. But as the time goes along here, let's remember that back in Jerusalem, we've had Josiah. There was something else I wanted to point out to you so that you could keep up with this. I'm going to put a number here. The number is of the sons of Josiah that ruled after him. Jehoahaz was the first son of Josiah who ruled after him. When Pharaoh Necho deposed Jehoahaz from the throne and took him away to Egypt, never to return to Israel again, he put a second son of Josiah upon the throne to rule. So Jehoiakim served Nebuchadnezzar until about 601. In 601, Nebuchadnezzar had gathered together another army, and he made his way down to the borders of Egypt to fight the Egyptians, to seek to defeat them so that they would not be any threat to him. But instead of his being able to defeat them, they defeated him. They defeated him so badly that all he could do was to pull back, and he went all the way back to Babylon. He spent the next 18 months building another army up. Now, during that very time is when Jehoiakim decided that he didn't have to be subject to Nebuchadnezzar after all, so he rebelled against him. Now, during the time that Nebuchadnezzar could not come with his main army, the Bible says that the Lord sent bands of the Chaldeans and the Moabites and the Ammonites, and they made raids on Judah and just generally afflicted Judah. Meanwhile, Nebuchadnezzar was getting that army ready. And it was ready by the end of the year 598. In December of 598, he mustered his troops, making ready to march to Jerusalem. And about that time, Jehoiakim died. Now, we're not told how, literally, how Jehoiakim died. But we do know this, that it wasn't pleasant. The prophet Jeremiah had foretold that when Jehoiakim died, there would be no one to regret his death. There would be no one to say, "Oh, my brother, oh, my father." There would be no one to mourn him. And he would be given the burial of a donkey, of a dead animal, dragged outside the city and cast forth. And in chapter 36, Jeremiah adds the point that the frost would collect on the dead body of Jehoiakim. So, we don't know. We're not told the details, but Jehoiakim died a death that was certainly commensurate with the kind of man he was. He was a wicked, wicked man, and yet a son of Josiah. It was this Jehoiakim who, when he was given the scroll of God, or when it was read to him, he asked for it to be given, and he took a penknife and shredded that scroll, burning it in a charcoal brazier that was located nearby as a kind of a space heater in the cool weather. And he just burned it, shredded it, and burned it. That was the man, Jehoiakim. So he died while Nebuchadnezzar was getting his troops mustered and making his trip to Jerusalem. His son, Jehoiachin, followed him. Now this man is called by various names. He's called Jeconiah, he's called Coniah, and so various names. But he only ruled 3 months. In their records and in their thinking, the Jews regarded him as the last legitimate king of Judah. And they reckoned the lineage of the Christ even. Now they didn't realize they were keeping the lineage of the Christ. But the lineage of the Messiah was reckoned through this man, Jeconiah. And one of the things that Jeremiah says about this man, Jeconiah, God says through Jeremiah, "Write this man childless." Now, it's not that Jeconiah did not have any children, but the point of God is, never shall a descendant of Jeconiah rule in Jerusalem and his kingdom prosper. Never happen. So, when Nebuchadnezzar reached Jerusalem in 597, Jehoiachin just meekly surrendered. It seemed that was the only thing he felt he could do. So he surrendered, and a number of other captives were taken about that time, and they were taken off to Babylon. Now then, take a moment and just, oh, isn't that terrible? Don't you feel sorry for these captives? Maybe not Jehoiachin particularly, but don't you feel sorry for those other captives that are taken away, whereas we get to stay home? We're getting to stay home, and they're having to go off to captivity. Isn't that terrible? One of the captives taken at the same time was Ezekiel. Oh, I feel sorry for Ezekiel. I feel sorry for these others. Well, apparently Jeremiah did also. And other people in Judah felt so sorry for them. And so God sent Jeremiah a vision. Jeremiah was shown of God 2 baskets of figs. God said, "Jeremiah, what do you see?" Jeremiah said, I see 2 baskets of figs. One of the baskets is filled with figs that are just so rotten you can't even eat them. The other basket is filled with nice figs. Look like they would be just right to eat. God said, "Jeremiah, that basket of good figs, that's the captives that have been taken away. I am going to look after them. I am going to care for them. And I will see to it that they are brought back here. But as for that basket of bad figs, that's the people who are left here. That is Zedekiah. And that's the Jews who are here. I am going to cause them to be tossed to and fro among the nations." So the captives that left were going to be actually better off than the people who remained behind. And so the actual last king was appointed by Nebuchadnezzar, and his name was Zedekiah, And Zedekiah was yet the third son of Josiah to rule upon the throne. That's the reason why the Jews reckon Jeconiah as the last of the legitimate kings. Because they thought that with Zedekiah, it went back on a level above Jeconiah. And so they did not consider him to be the legitimate king so far as the lineage of the children of David was concerned, or were concerned. Now then, I want to come back for a moment to Daniel. I mentioned a while ago that I would come back and say a little bit more about Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. I want to say a little bit about Daniel and Ezekiel. Because you see, with this taking away of captives in 597, we now have Ezekiel on the scene. Even though he doesn't begin to prophesy for a few more years, it's going to be a few more years after this before he begins to prophesy. But this would be a good time for us to note something about these two prophets. Daniel lived in the places of power. He lived and served in the palaces. Daniel was a man who looked face to face upon Nebuchadnezzar. He looked face to face with other kings of the Babylonian kingdom. He looked face to face with some of the great kings of the Persian Empire. So Daniel served in the courts of the kings, while Ezekiel served out among the people. The particular work that they did. You see, Nebuchadnezzar was the king who in just a few years would succeed in taking the city of Jerusalem, destroying the city where the name of God was, and destroying the temple where God had put his name. No king had ever been able to do that. It would have been entirely possible. In fact, it was likely that Nebuchadnezzar would think, hey, look what a great and mighty king I am to be able to do what no other king has ever done. And God wanted not only Nebuchadnezzar to be sure and understand what really happened, but God also wanted everyone else to know. So by preserving the book of Daniel, as God did, he made it possible first for Nebuchadnezzar to know that, no, Nebuchadnezzar, it was not because of your might and power that you were able to destroy Jerusalem and take my people away. The Most High rules in the affairs of men, Nebuchadnezzar, and he raises up whom he will, and he removes those from the throne that he chooses to remove. So that what has happened, you play a part in it. But it is the will and the plan of God at work. Meanwhile, out among the people, Ezekiel was sent to a people that God said had hard heads. And he said, Ezekiel, they're not going to listen to you. Their heads are very hard. And I don't want you to be intimidated by the looks they will give you. And don't be intimidated by their stubbornness, because I'm going to make your head harder than their heads. And you tell them what I have to say. Now they won't listen to you, but they will know there has been a prophet among them. What God wanted Ezekiel to do was to help the people to understand why they were taken away. The people themselves could have said, well, has the Lord lost his power? Has he just lost it all? Is that what's happened here? Maybe it's God's fault that we are being taken away into captivity. God could not allow that mistake to be made either. So among the people, Ezekiel functioned as the prophet of God, telling the people what was going on. Now, as we have said, Zedekiah was the last king to rule over Judah. And during the days of Zedekiah, he was a vacillating character. He was not as bad as, say, Jehoiakim was, but he was a character, one writer put it this way, where he had a wishbone where he should have had a backbone. I think that's an excellent description, not only of Zedekiah, but of a lot of people. He had a wishbone where he should have had a backbone. And on one occasion when things were really getting rough, it was obvious that the end was right out there. He came to Jeremiah in one of his sneaky little meetings with Jeremiah, and he said, Jeremiah, I've heard about times in the past when God did wondrous works. Maybe God will do a wondrous work for us, huh? Jeremiah said, forget. that is not about to happen. Instead of God doing a wonderful work and delivering you, why, God is going to fight against you. And so Zedekiah ruled, had the chance. He had the chance up until the last minute to save Jerusalem from destruction. God offered to the last minute that if you will give up, surrender to Nebuchadnezzar, then the city will be spared and it will not be burned and you can live here. But you will be subject to Nebuchadnezzar. You'll be subject to the Babylonian Empire, but you can live here. But Zedekiah would not accept that. He would not listen. He listened to others in his kingdom, the pro-Egyptian party, saying, no, we don't need to submit to Nebuchadnezzar. We can join with the Egyptians, and the Egyptians will give us victory. Well, the Egyptians couldn't do any such thing. Now, things are getting close. And before they got to the end, Ezekiel was given a vision. And this is one of the most important visions in the early part of Ezekiel. In Ezekiel chapters 8 through 11, we have a rather extensive vision that Ezekiel saw. Ezekiel was with his people when there appeared a man who looked like he was on fire from the waist down and of glowing metal from the waist up. And this obviously supernatural being took Ezekiel by the hair of the head and transported him instantly to Jerusalem, where he took him to the gate to the north enclosure of the temple. And there by the gate was an idol sitting, an image of jealousy. And Ezekiel, this is terrible. You know what's interesting? Ezekiel probably knew that was there. Already. He hadn't been gone from Jerusalem long. But these things are presented to Ezekiel in such a way as to make a very strong, shattering impression upon him. Then he took him and he showed him there was a hole in the wall. He said, dig in this hole in the wall. So Ezekiel dug and he came to a door. He said, now open that door. He opened the door and he went and it was dark in there. You couldn't see except where candles or torches were. But as he looked upon the walls, he saw that there was every form of creeping thing and so on. And the people were worshiping these things. They were worshiping these things in secret. And he observed certain of the leaders of Judah worshiping these things portrayed on the walls as gods. And God said to Ezekiel, I will show you more than this. Do you see what's going on? Do you see what's going on in the dark places? Do you see what my people are doing? I'll show you even worse things. And he took him out to the temple which faced the east. And there were 25 elders of the people led by Jaazaniah, and they were standing with their backs to the temple and they were facing the rising of the sun. And these men were prepared to worship the sun. A little bit earlier during the tour, he shows him women weeping for Tammuz. Tammuz was a pagan god of the order of Adonis, or one of the other gods of that world. The idea was that when the winter came on and all the vegetation died, that what really happened was there was somebody that died and went to the underworld. In the spring, whoever that was that went to the underworld comes back up. And spring, everything comes to life again. And as long as he's up here, up upon the earth, then everything's going to be green and growing and alive. And that happens every year. That was this kind of Tammuz. So they were weeping for Tammuz, who was supposed to have now died and gone to the underworld. Thorough paganism. That's all it was. And so God said, he gave a cry. Now Ezekiel is observing all these things that happened and God gave a cry. He said, have the men with their slaughter weapons to come forth. And so six men come walking forward with their slaughter weapons. And they're not described beyond that, but in my mind I have figured this had to be one of the most fearsome sights. Those men don't say a word. They walk with an awful purpose with their slaughter weapons, weapons of execution. And among them there is a scribe, easily detectable by having the little inkwell and the equipment that the scribe typically carried. And he is with these men. And God says to the scribe, take your pen and go through the city and mark everyone who weeps and is concerned for the wickedness of Judah. And I want you to observe the lesson here. I want you to see the lesson here. God was not saying, mark all of those who are weeping over the hard times that are coming. He didn't say, mark those that are worried about how we're going to get along when we don't get enough rain, or how, or if we have a drought, or if we have a famine. No, God says, go through the city and mark those who are concerned about the wickedness of my people. And then he told those six slaughtered men with their slaughter weapons, he said, now, go through the city and destroy everyone who does not have that mark, be it man, woman, or child, do not have mercy upon any of them. And begin here at my house. And as those men went forth with their slaughter weapons and began to slay in the vision, the men that were there worshiping the sun and the other people that were there in the temple worshiping the false gods and so on, they were just being slaughtered and slain. And Ezekiel is just so shocked. He says, Lord, Lord, wait a minute. This is terrible. And God says, Ezekiel, what these people are doing is terrible. And there's another great lesson. What we consider terrible is not what God considers terrible. And we need to learn to get ourselves in harmony with the way God looks at things. And so when Ezekiel objected to the slaughter that was going on, God said, Ezekiel, the wickedness of the people is great. In other words, therefore, I am not going to back off on this. That my judgment has come, my wrath has come. And in Ezekiel's vision, he saw the presence of God leave the temple. And that presence went out across what would later be known as the Kidron Valley. And over to that mountain, which in the New Testament is known as the Mount of Olives. And there God went and moved out of the city, looking over there at that same city that Jesus would look at and say, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that stoneth the prophets and killeth them that are sent unto her. Isn't that amazing? That here in this vision, God says, Ezekiel, help the people to understand that the reason why Nebuchadnezzar is going to succeed in taking that building over there and burning it, and the reason he's going to take that city over there and destroy it, is because it's not my city anymore. And that temple over there, it's not my temple anymore. I have nothing to do with it. Now that was a very important lesson, an absolutely vital lesson for them to learn. And so it was through Ezekiel that this vision was given. Now, in 586, in about 586, Jerusalem fell. Ezekiel had been told when the army was drawing near. Now he was told that by God himself. He actually just spoke to Ezekiel and said, Ezekiel, the armies of the Babylonians are drawing near to the city. During the time the Babylonians had the city besieged, the Egyptians came out for a battle. So the Babylonians up and left Jerusalem and went over there to fight the Egyptians. And when they did, all of the ungodly around Jerusalem said, yay, look at that. Our prophets were right. Their false prophets were saying that the Babylonians wouldn't complete this siege, that they would leave and whatever. And here the Babylonians were leaving, and it really looked like the false prophets were on a roll. But Jeremiah said, don't believe it. It is not going to happen. They're going to defeat the Egyptians, and they'll be right back. And that is exactly what did happen. So Ezekiel tells in chapter 33 of Ezekiel of the day when someone came all the way over there to the river Kibar. He had escaped from Jerusalem. We are not told the adventures that befell that person, how he made it. I have devoted just a little bit of thought occasionally, such things as that, thinking of whoever that was. obviously not a part of the captivity coming slowly and making its way. He had made his way over there somehow. And he got there to Ezekiel, and he said, "Ezekiel, the city of Jerusalem is fallen. I am escaped from it, and I have come, and I'm telling you that it's gone." And then God said to Ezekiel, "All right, Ezekiel, now the situation's going to be a little bit different. You have been vindicated. Nobody can come up to you and say, 'Don't you say that, Ezekiel. Jerusalem is not going to fall.' Nobody's going to be able to argue with you about that now, because the city has fallen. Obviously, you're right. So now you're going to have to beware of the tendency of the people. They're going to say, 'Hey, you want to come? Let's go and hear Ezekiel. Let's get together and go hear Ezekiel.' And it's going to look like you're popular, Ezekiel. And it's going to look like the people are going to come, and at last they're going to be willing to hear what you say. And they'll sit there and they'll look at you and they will listen as if they're just taking it all in. But don't be deceived, because what they're doing is sitting there like people who listen to someone who has a beautiful voice." Oh, I just love that deep voice of his. And they'll sit there and they'll be like people who are just enjoying your voice. Or like they would sit and listen to somebody play an instrument. But they're not taking it in. So you go ahead though and preach the word to them. And though they will not listen, though they will not actually take it in and let it become a part of them, yet they will know that there has been a prophet among them. So it's interesting that God said that to Ezekiel at the beginning of his career in chapter 3. And he tells him now, when he has been vindicated by the events coming true, the events he prophesied came true. He's been vindicated. And so he is told of God again, and this point is made. Now Nebuchadnezzar ruled for years. He ruled until 562. He took over at the same time, about the same time that Jehoiakim began his reign, about the same time that Daniel went away. So it was around 605, and he ruled until 562, long after this time. There's a story or two told in Daniel that we're not certain how to place that story. One of those is the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The story is that Nebuchadnezzar built a great image in the plain of Dura. And he commanded that all of the people should fall down and worship this great image that he had made when they hear the royal music. When the royal music played, everybody fell down and worshiped the great image that Nebuchadnezzar had made, except for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They had enemies. These enemies observed their refusal to worship the image of the king, and they could not wait to bring word to Nebuchadnezzar. And when Nebuchadnezzar heard that these three Jewish men, these three young men, had refused to bow down and worship his image, he called them before him, and he was extremely angry. Kings have a way of getting angry when you don't do what they tell you to do, no matter what it is. So he said, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, is it on purpose that you have not obeyed me? Do you not know that I have said that anyone who disobeys me is to be cast into the fiery furnace? And what God can deliver you out of my hand?" Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, you have just crossed the line that God will not tolerate you to cross. You have now done what Pharaoh did way back there when he said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him? I don't know any Jehovah, and I won't do what he says." Nebuchadnezzar has crossed that line when he said, "And what God can deliver you out of my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego said, "O king, we have no cause to answer you in this matter. Our God is able to deliver us from this. But whether he does or not, know this, O king, that we will not bow down nor worship the image that you have made." And so, faced with that kind of utter defiance and no give at all, no spirit of compromise at all, Nebuchadnezzar was infuriated beyond measure. And so he commanded that the furnace be heated 7 times hotter. And he commanded his men, they bound Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and carried them and threw them into the furnace. And the heat was so great that it overcame the very soldiers that threw Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in. And they died. And Nebuchadnezzar seated himself where he could watch these men burn in the furnace. But almost immediately he shouted, how many were thrown in? 3, O king. And how is it that I see 4 walking about in the midst of the furnace? And the aspect of the 4th is like unto a son of the gods. In other words, that was his way of saying, he looks like some supernatural being. And then he said, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, come forth. Come here. Very insistent. And so they came crunching over the white hot embers. Walking out, crunching on those embers that did not burn their delicate clothes or harm them in any way. And they kept coming out because Nebuchadnezzar himself had to be way back from that furnace. So they would have had a long way to walk as Nebuchadnezzar and all of his attendants were watching this. And they just kept coming forward until finally they stood here where they were away from the heat. You know the ropes that they were tied with? The ropes had been burned away as if they themselves were made of steel, unaffected by the fire. And the ropes had just been burned away. But even their delicate, fine clothing was not scorched. It was not hurt. Their hair was not singed. There was not even the smell of fire upon them. And as Nebuchadnezzar looked at them, he said, now I know that Jehovah, He is the only true God. Because there is no God who is able to do like this. And He made a law and a decree that anyone who spoke any word of criticism against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would be killed, hung on a post, and his house would be made a dung heap. Nebuchadnezzar was convinced. And also at some point in Nebuchadnezzar's career, and I'm not going to tell this whole story, but at some point in Nebuchadnezzar's career, he dreamed another dream, and that was of a great tree that was cut down, and the tree was himself. And Daniel interpreted the dream to it and said that you have been lifted up with pride. You have forgotten that God rules in the affairs of men. And your heart is going to be taken away and you're going to be given the heart of a beast until 7 times pass over you until you know that the Most High rules in the affairs of men. And Daniel even warned him, personally put his warning in, and yet the king did not give heed to that. And so it came to pass that that very thing happened. And Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom was kept for him until his mind returned to him again, until that day when he could lift up his eyes to heaven and say, now I know that Jehovah rules in the affairs of men. So Daniel continued his prophetic work during these years. Now Jeremiah had prophesied in Jeremiah 25, 11 and 12, and in Jeremiah 29 and verse 10, that the captivity would last 70 years. The years are going by. And Nebuchadnezzar, the only truly great king of Babylon, dies. So we have Nebuchadnezzar. And as Daniel said, he was the head of gold. Following Nebuchadnezzar, his son took over the throne. His name was Evil-Merodach. He only ruled for 2 years. He was assassinated. That often happened to these kings. He was assassinated, and a man named Nergal-Glisser took over. He didn't rule but about 4 years, and he died. And his infant son, called Labashi-Marduk, took over, except an infant son could not very well take over. And so, by the way, this occurred to me. Let me go ahead and put up one more king. One more king of the Babylonians, Nabonidus. One of these kings went to heaven. I know that because this poor little baby was killed. He was killed so that Nabonidus and his party could take over. And so, don't you feel sorry for that little baby that was killed there? But it was only because that baby was killed that he has the chance and the sure thing of going to heaven. And so that just occurred to me that these others, I don't have any hope. But this one, though he was killed as an infant, that punched his ticket to heaven. A lot of pagan babies went to heaven because they were killed as babies. You and I look upon something like that and we say, oh, how that's just horrible. How could God let that happen? Well, that's one that went to heaven. Good to bear in mind. Now this Nabonidus, when he took over, he immediately fell out with the priests of Marduk in Babylon. He didn't like them and they didn't like him. And by the time Nabonidus took over, things were already getting shaky in the Babylonian Empire. Now, we're almost through tonight. In fact, I think we are going to be through tonight. And I want to tell you what I'm going to do. Lord willing, I always remember the lesson of James 4. Lord willing, my plans are that next Lord's Day will be the last Lord's Day that I will be here for a week or so. I will be gone the next Sunday. And for your information, I'm going to have the privilege of being in a gospel meeting where Gary Fisher is preaching. So I'm going to get to visit with them and visit that church. And they've asked me to come and preach a few lessons on the Psalms. They have asked me to come and tell them about some Bible stories. They have asked me to come and talk to them about preaching Christ from the Old Testament. So, can you figure how I'm looking forward to that? So I have one more Sunday here, and what I'm planning to do is I'm going to complete this narration up to the coming of Christ. So that means that next Lord's Day, I want to deal with the return, the years of silence. And that'll be it then pretty well. So next Lord's Day, that's my plan. And then I'm going to wait a little while, and then I'm going to narrate the New Testament. So, several of you encouraged me to do this. And I've done it elsewhere some. But some of you encouraged me to do this here. And I have enjoyed it. I have thoroughly enjoyed it for my own sake. And a number of you have commented how you have enjoyed it. We have a complete set of tapes. We want to encourage you to use these tapes to refresh your memory, to give to other people, to help them to learn the story of redemption. And let's not lose sight of that story of redemption. Because even so, the plan of God is on track. He knows what He is doing. And even in these prophets like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, so deeply involved with the captivity and explaining what was involved in the captivity, yet those very writers were also looking forward to a time when God would send the branch of David, when there would be this glorious new temple built like no temple that was ever built. And it's going to be that spiritual temple of God, His dwelling place, which is that temple that Jesus Himself built and established. Tonight we ask you, are you a part of that spiritual temple that is the edifice in which God dwells today? It is not a masonry building. It is not a building made of lumber. It is a building made of people, a building made of souls. that have been saved by Jesus and added as living stones to that great temple that God lives in. Are you a part of that temple? If you're not, you can be tonight. If you will come unto Christ, who Himself was the great chief cornerstone, rejected indeed of men, but elect and precious with God, and also to all of those who believe. If you're willing to come to Him, the great chief cornerstone, then He will take you as a living stone, and He will make you a part of the house of God. That's a beautiful, absolutely awesome thought. There is no opportunity given to anyone on earth or in history that would compare to that opportunity. And don't ever forget that. There is no opportunity to be a king, to be a queen, to be a president, to be any being of power upon this earth. Nothing compares with that privilege of being a part of the house of God. If you're willing to meet the conditions of salvation, then you will become a part of that. Salvation will be yours. We hope you will come as we stand and sing.